You're listening to Cinema Jaw, the greatest movies podcast ever, recorded on location at the Original Mother's Nightclub in Chicago. My name is Matt Kay, and with me is...
Rye, the movie guy, and this week on Cinema Jaw, Matt, we go bigger than life as we cover our top three most ambitious film projects.
Yes, and this is a special episode, Ryan.
It is. We have our movie club pick of the month. This month, the Institute.
And this is rare for us. This is why I kind of wanted to keep this as a surprise. I'm very excited because we actually have the director of the Institute, Spencer McCall, as our guest this week.
How awesome is that?
It's beyond amazing.
When we first picked our first movie club pick of the month this year, which was Silent Running, we didn't get Bruce Dern on the show.
Nah, he was busy.
No, I know. Guy was preparing for the Oscars.
Yeah.
But Matt picked this movie. He came across it on Netflix, really stirred the jaw heads up, picking it as the movie club pick. Spencer was nice enough to reach out to us on Twitter. We got in touch with him, and he said, yeah, he's coming on.
Yeah, and I can't wait to tell Spencer the story of how I came across this film. It's very interesting.
I can't wait to talk to Spencer and see how he was involved with the Institute. I mean, the game being played and what he knew about it before filming.
Yeah, let's jump
all
in.
Right, well, okay, all right. Well, hold on. We got a full show here, Matt.
Tell me about
all
it,
right. All right. Besides the Institute, we also are going eye for an eye on The Sex Tape or Sex Tape, new movie with Cameron Diaz.
Okay.
I have a review for you of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Very excited about that.
Also, Boyhood is coming out. This is the new Richard Linklater film where he filmed a boy at different points of his life for 12 straight years. Also, Ethan Hawke is in the film. Hit a lot of the festivals and all the critics absolutely love this film. I'm dying to see it. It comes out here in Chicago this weekend. That and the fact that we have Spencer on, who is doing this Institute film that was, quite ambitious.
Sure,
that's how we came up with the topic, top three most ambitious film projects.
I think this is a great topic.
It is. And I told you too over text, it didn't necessarily mean if it was ambitious, it didn't have to be successful.
I have one failure on my list.
Good, good. Mine were all successful. I figured you would pick up the slack with the failures.
I have one that it's an interesting story.
All right, that's good. In addition to that, I also wanted to bring up the fact that I saw like The Expendables 3, I think, is coming out, and it somehow got a PG-13 rating, which I find hard to believe. I think they got to clamp down a little bit harder on that PG-13.
I think they should just get rid of PG-13. It's outdated. It's old.
What are you talking about? Just get rid of the entire rating?
Yeah. It's PG or it's R.
No way. You got to at least have a PG-13 right
Why?
In the middle.
You need an in-betweener?
Yeah, for sure.
Cinema War.
Oh, boy. Matt, that is going to be good right there. Mm. And also, in addition to Sex Tape coming out, you'll be taking Spencer on in Cameron Diaz, Jason Segel movie trivia.
Oh, God. All right.
Boy, oh, boy. Jam-packed jaw as always, Matt.
Yeah, let's jump in. I'm very excited.
Yes. So without further ado, we bring in our guest. He is the director of The Institute. It is streaming on Netflix. It premiered, I know, here in Chicago, actually, at the Chicago Film Critics Association Film Festival. And it's
a mouthful.
It is. It's a long festival name. It's an honor to have Spencer McCall on Cinema Jaw. Welcome.
Hey, thank you guys very much for having me.
We should mention that Spencer is joining us via Skype from San Francisco.
Yeah, I'm not live in the studio, unfortunately.
But you sound great.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Do you do voiceover work for a living there, Spencer?
Not exactly. I do tutorial video work, video voiceover work occasionally. But I just have a good USB mic.
Nice, man. So right before we started recording, you let a major cat, or actually a dog, out of the bag. You were telling us about your job before, so you got to tell that story.
So I'm originally from just outside Reno, Nevada, but I went to San Francisco for college. I had a friend who was a business major. It's kind of like a long story, but I had a friend who was a business major who got me connected. He was doing like a little seminar thing, and he got me connected with some people who needed some video work done. But they wouldn't tell me what it was. They just had me sign an NDA. The next thing I know, I pull up to this house to edit some videos, and like five dogs run out to me to like meet me. And, you know, I love dogs, but I don't know too much about like pedigrees or different breeds, but they all looked very similar. They were all very similar looking dogs. And it wasn't until I met this like kind of weird, eccentric, super rich dude who decided that he wanted to clone his dog, who had died like in 2001, and this was in 2008, and these were all the exact same dogs. So pretty much my first job out of college was working for this company called BioArts International that did dog cloning. So I got to go like kind of all over the world filming kind of like these promotional propaganda pieces about dog cloning and how happy it makes people. And
I think this was a perfect lead up to the Institute, honestly.
Yeah. So yeah, that's what I used to do.
That's actually, it's crazy to think that you went from that to making the Institute. Was this your first feature film, the Institute?
Yeah, this was, besides kind of like messing around with friends and doing like little sketch shorts, this was sort of my first real film that I decided to take seriously. You know, I've always messed around with like video and editing, as like a lot of people have. But when I stumbled upon this story and the fact that there was this much, this large a community involved and this much media attached to it, I figured it was a good time to maybe take something seriously, I guess.
And are you a fan of documentaries in general? Like Matt Cahill will watch everything that's on Netflix. If it's a documentary and it's on Netflix, Matt stumbles across it somehow. He gives us those reviews.
Yeah, no, that's not exactly true. I'm a fan of documentaries, so I do watch quite a few of them on Netflix.
You know what's funny is like I'm not that diehard. I'm like not diehard documentary enthusiastic. I like documentaries. There's a bunch I really do like. And, you know, if we come to that list later on, there's a couple documentaries that I'd like to mention for Most Ambitious. I like everything. I don't have like a favorite of anything. I like genre pieces. I like documentaries. I just like a lot of stuff.
Do you like horror?
Actually, you know what? Horror is probably on the bottom of my list.
Well done, Spencer. Well done.
What about superhero films, Spencer?
Yes and no. I have a good time watching them. I've enjoyed them. I'm not gonna like hate on them. There's a time and place for superhero films. I'm definitely not diehard about them.
I like it. I like the Spencer guy already.
Yeah, I'm I'm into the more you know, let's say, I don't want to say lowbrow, but the blockbuster type.
No, you can
movies.
Go ahead and say lowbrow.
No,
go ahead. You were about to say it, Matt. Go ahead.
No.
Well, it's funny that you're going to review the new Planet of the Apes, because the original Planet of the Apes, the 68 version, is like one of my top five favorite films of all time. So I'm really eager to see it. Yeah. Really eager to check it out.
Yeah. Review coming up here momentarily. And I'll just let you know, I was a big fan, and I am a big fan of the 68 too. I love Charlton Heston in that film. And you obviously saw Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I love how they even brought that together, how you saw the astronauts first getting in the capsule on TV. I loved all that, you know?
It was awesome. For sure.
Way to connect the series. Sure. So Spencer is going to be sitting in now. Jawheads, we're holding back a little bit of the interview because obviously he directed our pick, The Institute.
Yes.
So we want to really talk about Spencer, the filmmaker, how he made the film, when we tackle The Institute here in about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So, Matt, it brings us to Eye for an Eye, Interest or Ignore, and Eye for an Eye is sponsored by
the new 400 Theater.
Whoa, tell me more.
It is the best place for first-run movies in Chicago. They got great prices. My favorite, Spencer, they have a full liquor bar. If you're ever in Chicago and you want a beer with your movie, this is
Love
the
it.
Place to go, man.
Plus, love Chicago.
Plus, they are playing classic movies on Friday and Saturday night, so check out what's playing
at thenew400.com, and we thank them for their support.
Eye for an Eye this week, Matt, Sex Tape. A married couple wake up to discover that the sex tape they made the evening before has gone missing, leading to a frantic search for its whereabouts. The film stars Cameron Diaz and Jason Segel. This film is directed by Jake Kasdan, who has directed Walk Hard, The Dewey Cox Story, and also Bad Teacher. Matt, interested or ignore on Sex Tape?
I'm interested in the MacGuffin. I want to see the sex tape with Cameron Diaz. I don't know if I want to see this movie, so that might have been a premature ring there. I don't know, man. I like Jason Segel, and I do like Cameron Diaz. She still has a little bit of a place in my heart from Something About Mary, so maybe it's a rental.
We throw it over to Spencer. Interest or ignore on Sex Tape?
I'm sorry, guys. I hate pessimism. I hate overt criticism, but I'm just going to ignore this one.
I think that's a safe bet.
Yeah,
hey, Spencer, yeah. I'm actually right with you. I don't know what's with comedies this summer. It's been seems tough to come across one. Last week I had to review Tammy. That was terrible. A couple weeks before that I had to review Blended. That was even worse. I didn't even really like Neighbors that much.
You like 22 Jump Street.
22 Jump Street was pretty decent.
I like 22 Jump Street. I like 21 Jump Street even more, surprisingly. And I hadn't seen it before. I was about to see 22, but man, that one killed me.
It sure
yeah,
did.
It's good.
So for me, Sex Tape, it just looks ridiculous. I mean, it's one of these ideas. They came up with like a funny premise. I don't know how they're going to make an entire movie out of that. I'm ignoring this thing. More or less three ignores.
Yeah, three ignores. Let's
just... three ignores. Matt does want to see the actual sex tape of
I would like
Jason
to see
the... Segel.
Yeah, no, no.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'd love to see this the sex tape, but I don't know.
And you know they're not going to show anything. That's you know.
I agree.
It's disappointing.
I read a thing that this is her, I don't know if it's true or not, but that this is the first film that Cameron Diaz is going,
topless?
You know.
Topless?
Something in. A revealing in.
Let's go back right around the room. Matt, interest or ignore on Sex Tape?
I'm interested now.
Spencer, interest or ignore on Sex Tape?
I mean, I already knew that, so I'm going to hold to my guns. ignore.
Right?
Maybe the mask era.
Oh, boy. Just joking. Just joking.
No, you can't joke.
All right, I'll go interested as well.
Yeah, there you go.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Oh, boy. Actually, though, three ignores. Stay away from it, jawheads.
Yeah.
Speaking of new movies, though, Matt, I got out to the theater and caught Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
I know why you're scared. It took us 4 years fighting that virus, but we are survivors.
It was a virus created by scientists in a lab. You can't blame the apes.
Who the hell else am I gonna blame?
We need to give him a chance.
Welcome to animals.
Please. I've seen things. I've seen the way they are. They want what we want to survive.
Caesar, home. This is your home. Your home.
Are you aware they are going to turn on you?
They don't want a war.
No, don't shoot!
Caesar, you have to go.
Go? Where?
Apes! Together! Strong!
War, it's not what you want. There must be another way.
Matt, no one was more shocked than I was at how great Rise of the Planet of the Apes turned out. And when there is success in Hollywood, you can always expect one thing, a sequel. Well, I have good news, jawheads. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is also a major success. The film starts with a montage of what's happened across the globe. The story is set 4 years after the first film opens, with the apes living among themselves in the woods just north of San Francisco. An early scene of the apes hunting deer in the forest is downright terrifying. The apes are in the early stages of being able to talk, so they rely on communicating via sign language. A group of humans stumble across the intelligent apes led by Caesar while trying to find a dam needed to get electricity back to San Francisco. They strike up a peace with Caesar to work at the dam, but that is short-lived. An ape by the name of Koba does not believe humans can live alongside them and wants to start a full-scale war. Matt, the special effects here are spectacular. They did an amazing job not only with Caesar, but all of the main apes. The film also captures the fear of being around these fierce animals. Gary Oldman plays the San Francisco's mayor of sorts, and Jason Clarke, most known, I guess, for Zero Dark Thirty, plays Malcolm, the man who is working on the dam and someone Caesar trusts. However, the star of this film, and it should be no surprise, is Andy Serkis, who turns in another stellar motion capture performance. The film, I would say, is not as good as its predecessor, mainly because the first film's ideas were so fresh. There are not many surprises in Dawn of the Apes. It moves the storyline along the known path that we know it's going to take, and it's a dark path at that. However, when it comes to the action sequels I've seen, this is one of the better ones. Ride the Movie Guy's grade, 3.5 Jaws.
My only question is, okay, so this one's successful too. You know there's going to be another one.
Oh, for sure.
What are they going to call that one?
Well, I don't know. It's going to be World of the Planet of the Apes.
Afternoon of the Planet of the Apes.
Tea Time of the Apes.
Yeah. This is a good question. We can go round robin on this all day.
Yeah.
Well, at the end of the third one, are the astronauts going to land?
I wonder that too. And really the third one, I mean, where this one leaves off, I didn't know there would be room for three movies before. Because obviously the first one set up the idea of how the apes got their intelligence. The second one set up the idea that there was going to be a war and somehow the apes were going to rule the planet. The third one, I don't know if it's just going to be all-out war or what. You know what I mean?
War of the Apes.
Hey, not bad.
Yeah.
But really, the special effects, they have them down. A lot of times when you're watching these movies, like the Marvel movies in particular, there's so much, awesome special effects going on screen, computer-generated this and that.
It's almost overwhelming.
It's almost overwhelming. But here, I think maybe it's a little bit darker of a scene, a darker of a movie. There's like a night battle with the apes. They look so damn real. It's not even that you're conscious of the fact that you're looking at computer generated apes. You know, it just looks awesome. You know, and they're wielding machine guns, and you just buy it wholeheartedly.
But I wonder,
it's so awesome, and they're on horseback. And
I wonder if in the Charlton Heston classic, the people of the '60s saw that and said, "Oh, that makeup looks so real."
Well, it did at the time.
I guess it did.
Probably, yeah.
I wonder if it'll hold up.
And maybe in the third one, to sort of transition the series together, maybe some of the apes should be in costume and some of them should be computer generated.
I think that's a great idea, actually. Take a page out of J.J. Abrams' book.
Yeah, the Sunnis and Shiites. There's the makeup ones, the CG ones.
And the second Planet of the Apes after the Charlton Heston is called Beneath the Planet of the Apes, correct?
That's
the one where they're in the subways a lot and stuff. And this one ties in a lot of references to the subways and getting the humans down there as they're trying to, you know, control them at one point. And I love that they're tying in that original series.
Well, even the fact that his name is Caesar is a reference to Battle of the Planet of the Apes with, was it Christopher Lee? I think it was, where Caesar's a circus ape that decided to become smart or something in the old 70s spinoff movie. Yeah.
It's amazing how many Planet of the Apes movies there have been.
Yes.
But these last two probably are the two best after the Charlton Heston, I would say. I mean, I believe I've seen all of them, if not, maybe I missed one of those early ones. But these two, I love them both. You'll have to check this one out, man.
I got to go on a Planet of the Apes marathon.
Do it.
Including the Tim Burton, right?
Yeah.
He did.
Yeah.
That was an awful one. You can skip that one.
Yeah.
There's things about it I don't hate.
Really? Wow. Yeah. We'll have to talk off here.
Yeah.
All right. So Jawheads, 3.5 Jaws for Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. If you're checking it out this weekend, shoot us a tweet at CinemaJaw. We'll retweet it and get the discussion going. Matt, every month we try to pick a movie as the CinemaJaw Movie Club pick.
Yep.
And for the first time ever, I gave you full range to pick whatever you wanted.
Yeah.
I just said, hey, Matt, it's your pick. And you came across a movie that really stirred you.
It did, and I want to set the stage. So I'm home at night, and I was already on kind of a Netflix.
Wait! What were you wearing?
Ryan, I refuse to answer that question. My CinemaJaw T-shirt.
Oh,
okay,
nice, all right. Nice.
So, you know, I'm already on a Netflix documentary marathon. So I had watched Tiny, which was that movie about houses. They were all good. I forget what the second one was. Oh, Magic Camp. And then I'm like, okay, one more. And I was, I'll be honest, Spencer, don't take this the wrong way. I just read the description on Netflix. I had known nothing about this, although maybe Mark Dusick planted it in the back of my head somewhere, because somebody did come on the show and talk very highly about this movie. But I watched it half expecting I'm going to fall asleep. And then it started an amazingly hooked me right away, and you're about to hear a gushing review, Spencer, because I freaking love this movie. I couldn't wait to talk to you, Ryan, about it. I just seriously tumbled down this rabbit hole. I knew nothing about this movie, so I didn't know that it was going to be this trip. So I experienced it for the first time with a complete open mind, thinking it was going to be a straight documentary about an augmented reality game that took place in San Francisco, a straightforward documentary, and it keeps going and getting more and more surreal and adding more layers and more layers. And I was just like, come on, this is unbelievable. And I fell straight down, and I have to say, the experience I had, I walked away from this movie loving it, absolutely loving it. I came on to Cinema Jaw, and I may not have said this on the air, but
And tell the Jawheads a little bit about what it's about.
Okay, yeah, we should.
Because originally you did not describe it. I told you to hold your tongue.
So the Institute, I would say, it's about this augmented reality game, which took place in San Francisco, and correct me if I'm wrong, Spencer, between 2008 and 2011. Mm-hmm. And it heavily involved a group called the Jejun Institute. But the way players got involved with this game is first they started to see flyers around San Francisco. And the flyers had phone numbers, little tabs you can rip off like you commonly see on flyers. And the phone numbers had a voicemail that brought you to this building in the financial district of San Francisco where you went up the elevator and you met the secretary. This all happened to very many people in San Francisco. And then you were led to this room and bizarre things, you know, you watched a truly bizarre video in this room, and then you were given a set of instructions, which was mostly just I don't want to say an easy scavenger hunt, but it was definitely an attainable list of, if not slightly artistic and strange, list of objectives. But then it got even stranger after that. There was like a second chapter that came out, and the movie, I think, at some point, it's fair to say, and I know we're going to get into this with Spencer, takes you, like Exit Through the Gift Shop, which I mentioned as what I would compare this movie to, takes you on a bit of a ride itself. I think, you know, obviously, and I don't know how much of this you'll own up to, Spence, but there are some parts of the film that are part of the game.
Right.
They're not necessarily straightforward documentary. At least that is my opinion. I don't know how much of this we'll get to talk about, but And that's my major criticism for the film. If I had to pick one thing that took me out of the story is when the consultant guy at the end comes in. And I want to, no spoilers, I don't want to give too much away.
Oh, yeah, okay.
There's one interview that's done, and I'll just say in character, that I thought at that point I my suspension of disbelief broke just a little bit, but you got me back at the end. Like I was like, okay, hang on, this is, something's not right. But then, wait a second, this actually did take place. I'm looking on Wikipedia. It's real. So it blurs the line between documentary and narrative. You don't know how much of this film is truth and how much of it is fiction. And I think that's part of what makes it so fun and enjoyable. I can't recommend it enough. If I have to give it a rating here on Cinema Jaw, I would say 4 Jaws all the way.
Nice.
Kind of didn't know what to think. I at first thought, okay, someone's making these crazy advertisements for something that's almost too impossible to even exist. And they seem to be urging me to visit this physical place.
You now sit in a satellite induction office of the Jejun Institute, located in the deep forests of San Francisco.
San Francisco for 11 years and had to leave because of gang stalking activities and being surveillanced and monitored and all the frequency manipulation. And it's a really serious thing to have done to somebody.
I saw a way to play that was entirely new, and them treating it like a game offended me.
And at that moment, it really didn't feel like a game anymore. It was genuinely scary, yeah.
There was moments where, you know, the ordinary world was transformed into something different, something full of potential and full of mystery.
And everything outside seems better. Like the colors are brighter or the world looks like a different place. And I wanted to keep feeling that way.
You may suddenly begin to notice small things around you you had never before noticed. until your entire universe is transformed forever.
Matt, after viewing this movie and thinking of my Cinema Jaw review, I thought if me and Matt lived in San Francisco, would we have participated in the Jejun Institute?
I know I would have.
And the answer is this. It probably would have piqued my interest, but I do not think I would have followed in that much. Matt, on the other hand, would have dove in with his clothes on and would have not stopped until he was the president of the fan club. The parts I love most, this was my favorite part, Spencer, was the sort of the fantastic elements of the game being played. For instance, I absolutely adored the scene where the guy gets a clue to go to a payphone. He gets a random call, and on that call, he's told to start dancing. And as he's dancing, the camera's getting him from a far point of view, and he's dancing. And then all of a sudden, this guy just walks up with a boombox and starts playing music and starts dancing along with him, which at this point, this guy's freaking out. And it doesn't stop there. Then all of a sudden, a guy dressed in a
Yeti.
Yeah, a Yeti.
A Bigfoot, a Yeti, yes. Comes, Sasquatch, if you will.
Yes, a Sasquatch. He comes and just looks ridiculous on the street. He starts dancing with the guy and hands him their next clue. That kind of element, I wanted more of that, like more kinds of clues to sure. keep going on. Because that was my favorite part. I thought, well, boy, if that was going on, I'd be hook, line, and sinker in this game. But as far as going up this building, watching this TV little segment that they had, I probably would have stopped the game right there for me if I was playing along. Matt, on the other hand, like I said.
Oh, that would have been just the beginning.
I'm actually right there with you, and I can get into that in a minute. But
sure.
Yeah, I was not somebody to participate in this.
Okay, good. Well, we got a series of questions here. For my take here, Ride the Movie Guy's great, a solid 3 Jaws for the Institute. I enjoyed it, but probably not as much as Matt Kay.
I just want to highlight one more scene, Spence, before we dive in here. There's this one part of the film that's so moving for me, and actually I completely relate. There is this young lady on who gets elsewhere, which is a word that comes up quite a bit. It's a theme in the
Oh, nonchalance.
Film. Yeah, right. She gets it tattooed inside her wrist, and she is moved to tears by her experience with the game, the Jejun Institute game. And it's so beautiful. Like, I hope that was real.
Well, and
so beautiful.
Wait, before Spencer answers, and I see him about to, and here, because he may ruin my theory on this, probably why I wasn't hook, line, and sinker on it was, obviously there were elements in this movie that were acted out. I mean, there were some characters on screen, and this whole thing was not a full-scale documentary. Not everybody on there participated as were... not acting. There were some actors involved. And at that point, I started thinking, what if she's an actor? Granted, maybe that's the point of the movie, is I'm sort of playing along with the game, but at that same point, I'm like, well,
I have to question everything.
Right, and then I started to lose sort of my emotional tie, like you're saying, you were moved by that moment. To me, I wasn't at all. If anything, I was skeptical. I thought, is she acting or not?
If she was acting, she deserves a fucking Oscar. Okay?
she wasn't acting. No.
That's good. That's good. So 3 Jaws from Ride the Movie Guy, 4 Jaws from Matt Kay, and now we have the director on to discuss the film as well. First and foremost, you say you weren't involved prior to, I guess, start with the very beginning when you first heard of the Institute and the game being played in San Francisco.
Cool. So how I got involved? Oh, that was the question?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, you know, the dog cloning company that I was working for, this was 2008, you know, nobody was buying $150,000 replicas of their dead dog. So the company went out of business and I started just kind of doing like freelance video editing whenever I could. Meanwhile, I was still doing kind of just messing around with a couple like actor-y friends of mine who do a lot of like improv and... we would just do like kind of silly little sketch stuff, the stuff that like everyone does basically on the internet. And one of these friends is named Gordo, who was working at this costume store down on kind of by Haight-Ashbury. When he relays his story in the film of basically seeing this weird guy putting these flyers up all over the street. You know, Gordo had gone through the first phase of the Jejun Institute and then approached this guy because he kind of knew what this was. And this mysterious guy, Bobby Peru, said, yeah, come down, meet with us. And so Gordo did. And Gordo kind of mentioned that he was like an actor and he was good with improv. And he ended up going downtown and leading like this street protest with 200 people. He had no expectation of doing this at all. He did it. They shook his hand and, you know, he never saw them again. But he did, during the course of this, sometime mention he had a friend. I guess the people involved behind the scenes said they needed some video work done. And he mentioned he had a friend who did some video stuff. So he gave him my name. Yeah, I mean, I don't want it to be too long a story, but basically over the course of the next like 3 years, I never met anybody, but I would get these random emails and these hard drive packages in the mail saying, can you edit this for us? Here's like the transcript. Here's the footage. You need to do it. Edit it for us. Send it back to us. And finally, this was like from 2009 to 2011. Finally, in 2011, they sent me a master hard drive and said, we need a couple video, you to edit a couple of videos, send it back to us. And so I did. And then that was like, I guess, right when they were going out of business or like shutting down. And they never, you know, I never got paid really for any of this. I just thought it was like interesting work to do. I got paid a little bit.
What kinds of things were on these drives? I'm very curious.
It was so random. It was like archival footage from the 70s, like security camera footage, logos, fonts, voiceover tracks. And they just say like assemble like so and send it back to us. And they'd give me like, you know, for like a 3 minute video, maybe like $100. I was unemployed. So I was like, all right, sure. That sounds great. They sent me a master hard drive and then I edited some stuff for them. They never paid me. So I go, okay, well, at least I got a hard drive out of this. And I started looking at the hard drive and there was just like hundreds and hundreds of hours of footage. And I started thinking, man, I could do something like that. I could do something with this. Like, I don't know what this project is. Nobody knows what this project is. Maybe I can try to like answer that question for people. And, you know, it's rare for anybody to come across a treasure chest of just footage, right? Enough footage to make a feature film. It's like what's preventing a lot of people from making a feature film is they just don't have the assets or the money. And this was just like this treasure chest that just took me assembling it.
So you actually didn't film much of the film. I mean, there's no scenes that you filmed yourself or?
No, actually that's not. So basically there was a lot of like footage, but I needed like player footage, but I didn't know what any of it meant. I could organize it chronologically on my computer, but in order to have it make any sense, I started reaching out to some of the people and some of the names I was hearing in this footage, looking them up on Facebook and saying, hey, were you involved with the Jejun Institute? Could I interview you on camera? And they'd say, okay, sure. And then I would just do like these 6 hour interviews where I just brought a DSLR and interviewed them with like a little lav mic.
Sure.
And had them basically tell me what it was I was looking at on this footage, at this footage I had. And then after that, I had to do a lot of walkthroughs as well, where there was no footage of people like going up Coit Tower or going through the first phase or doing like the binaural audio recording. So it was mostly for me just like walkthroughs, video recording and interview video recording, and then splicing that in with the footage I had.
It's absolutely mind-blowing. There's so much of this film, which we touched upon, that's questionable as to what's real and what's not.
All right, first question I have for you is Eva, what her name, there's a girl that's missing in the film, and this is sort of what starts the whole idea, and a lot of people, I guess the film gives the theory of maybe they put on this game in her honor. Is she a real person? Do we know this? Her name is Eva. I might butcher her last name. Lucien.
Evolution.
Nice. There we go.
Eva is based on a real person. The, okay. the footage, the reenactment footage shot on the VHS camcorder, that's an actress. I'm being more candid probably than I should because I like people guessing. She's based on a real person who did go missing in the 80s, who Jeff knew. And he used kind of her like philosophy and who she was as like the basis for this project. Now, he had other influences as well, but focusing it around like the disappearance of somebody was pretty interesting and something that was never told to anybody involved until I finally got to interview Jeff when he finally like let it slip, basically, that Ava's based on an old girlfriend who, you know, most likely got like kidnapped or abducted. And it's great. You know, she wasn't somebody who would have committed suicide, as Jeff says in the film. And it's pretty horrendous to think of somebody getting like abducted, especially somebody you love, that it's great to think of them going somewhere else. And as like maybe an agnostic or an atheist, I'm not sure if even Jeff is either of those things. He might be, you know, a very religious person, but he wouldn't open up about that. The idea that somebody didn't necessarily go here and get murdered or go there and whatever, they went elsewhere and that's where they are and that's where they're safe. It's kind of like a pretty thought, you know, it's, they're not here, they're not there, they're not heaven, they're not in hell, they're just elsewhere. And that was kind of like the basis for his idea of putting a euphemism to a disappearance, I guess.
Gotcha.
I mean, I'm completely in awe. The movie, it's tough for me to get my thoughts together because as you're talking, I'm just enjoying so much of it's kind of like a trip, you know. It really is an acid trip almost. There's so much of it that's all right. Well, first of all, did we even establish who Jeff is and his other projects around town? Because he's done some pretty important stuff.
So, yeah, Jeff basically made his money creating, I hate to call it like a glorified T-shirt company, but there's a company in Oakland called Oaklandish, like Oakland Outlandish, that basically made like a bunch of like pro-Oakland T-shirts that a lot of the proceeds donate nonprofits. And they kind of became like a stylistic icon in the Bay, like people... You'll see an Oaklandish shirt all over the place. And that was, I think, partially the funding for the Jejun Institute, partially the funding for this project. I know there was also some grants and also like myself, there were just like a lot of basically volunteer contributors who thought it was like an interesting project that they wanted to see get fulfilled. So it was a mix of Oaklandish money, which is a company Jeff started, not too unlike, you know, like a clothing company that Terry Guetta started and Exit Through the Gift Shop,
right.
Mixed with a couple grants, a couple private investors, and then volunteers.
And then now this ended, what year did it end? The game ended in 2010, did we say?
2011.
11. And obviously this film came out last year. 2013?
Yes. You know, the funny thing is I started working on it in the end of 2011. I started like shooting it in October of 2011 and then was working on it basically for about a year and like a half. And then we sent it out and it got into some festivals, which was like a total shock. Somebody was just like, you should submit it to film festivals. I was just doing it kind of originally to share with the community of like the people who were involved. And then they were like, you should just submit it to some festivals. And I was like, all right, whatever. So I did. And then, you know, I'm still like reeling from all of this stuff. But yeah, we got into some and then. You know, some were just fun to get into, but then it was really Slam Dance in Park City during Sundance that really kind of blew this whole thing up, and it became something bigger than anybody thought it would, I guess.
And since that time, once it sort of blew up from Slam Dance, did you hear back from Jeff and some of the participants that took place in the game?
Sure. Well, that was part of the thing. So I started interviewing people back in the end of 2011 and 2012. And once word reached a lot of the basically, I started interviewing a lot of the people who were really involved in the games. And unbeknownst to me at the time is some of them had like developed relationships with Jeff. So as I started interviewing people, Jeff and like Uriah and Sarah, they contacted me and said, okay, it's all right that you're doing what you're doing, but you need to speak with us. Like, you need to interview us. And it was at that point that I really like, I kind of like met them for the first time and told them what I was hoping to do with this. And they said, okay, fine, do whatever you want. That's cool. You know, it's ended anyway. Do what you want, but we want to at least get an opportunity to get our voice in there. So I interviewed them. That was about like midway through production for me.
Now, I know one of the jawheads that we've had on the show a couple of times, Mark Dusick, he had mentioned it when he was on here, boy, a year and a half ago. He joined us a couple months ago, too. He was kind enough to give us his thoughts on the Jaw Hotline. Matt, roll that clip.
Hey, Matt, Bry, Elias, and Jawheads everywhere. It's Mark Dusick, film critic from MarkReviewsMovies.com. And I just wanted to say a few thoughts about the Institute, which is Cinema Jaw's movie club pick this time around. It's kind of funny, actually, because I saw the Institute at the first annual Chicago Critics Film Festival, and I was on the show for the first time shortly after I was at that festival, and I mentioned that was the best movie that I got to see at the festival. So I'm really happy that you guys picked it for the movie club, and I'm really happy it's on Netflix, too, so people can check it out. What I really like and admire about the film is how its form is kind of a perfect complement to its subject. You have this kind of scavenger hunt going on, and instead of just using talking heads of people who participated and were affected by this performance art piece, you actually try to go through the process of going through the scavenger hunt, and it gets us involved, and it makes us feel like a fly on the wall through the whole process. And it's really just fascinating and engrossing. I liked it so much, in fact, that I listed it on my honorable mention section for the 10 best films of 2013. So I hope everybody got to check it out. And if you haven't, be sure that you do. And that's it from me. Enjoy the discussion of the film. It's a really good one. And hope to see you guys soon.
What I like there about what Mark mentioned was that he mentions about being a fly on the wall and sort of playing along with the game. And did you feel when you were making the film, as far as editing it all together, as you had mentioned, like you were sort of almost a fly on the wall spying on these participants?
Definitely. What's really important to me and what I use to judge like whether a film, especially like a fantastical or a science fiction film, is good, and I consider this almost like a fantasy documentary or like a fantasy or science fiction documentary. What's important is that any film really observes its own rules. And so what was really important to me is that, and I followed a three-act structure. You know, you have the first act where you introduce the world, and then the second where it like takes this creepy, weird turn into the dark, into like this pit, and then the third where people try to crawl out of it, but maybe they don't get exactly what they were expecting out of it. The first act was really important for me to introduce that people thought this was a cult. There was another agency trying to take down this cult, and there were people involved with this who are actors. And there are people involved with this who are deliberately BSing everybody involved.
Right.
There are plants, basically. And one of those was Gordo. And so initially, right off the bat, I say Gordo, the guy who leads the protest. I let people know he was a guy who does improv. He didn't know what he was doing. He was just playing along with the role. And that was the rule that I felt was important to give to the audience that, all right, going forward, I don't need to tell you that people are actors anymore because I already told you that somebody involved in this, like people involved in this are actors. And so what happened to me in the second act is that I really wanted to put the audience into the perspective of one of the participants of the game, where a lot of the participants, they didn't know who Gordo was. They didn't know if he was just a crazy person or a game designer or an actor or, you know, what. They didn't know. And I thought it would be unfair and just unfair to not give the audience watching this movie a chance to feel the way a lot of the participants felt. And so, you know, later in the film, maybe I just felt that I had already mentioned some people are BSing you or BSing the players involved, and I don't need to say it again. It would just be redundant at that point.
Mm-hmm. I have to say it's the best scavenger hunt movie since Midnight Madness with Michael J. Fox.
Seriously, man, I almost wonder how much of, you know, if some of the things you're saying are false, because I fell that deeply down the hole, Spencer. I mean, like, if you got these hard drives from this company and they gave you these very hazy instructions on how to edit together some videos and then let you keep the footage, it's almost like they wanted you to have all this, which is just too strange of a coincidence, man, isn't it? I mean, do you ever think about that?
I do think about that a little bit, but so there's a couple things there. One is these people were creating a project that was kind of autobiographical, in that the concept of somebody who's a nonchalant is somebody who's so brilliant that they're unable to function in the real world. You know, like basically a perfect example is a Stephen Hawking. He's so brilliant, but he is unable to walk around or even speak for himself. Stephen Hawking is a wonderful, beautiful nonchalant. Another example is, you know, maybe a crazy person who is on the street and he's talking to himself, but he's written like a manifesto that's giant. I think with Jeff, he's just like, he's brilliant, definitely brilliant. I wouldn't even call him like somebody I know very well, even after all of this. But at the same time, he came into my house one time. Well, he's going to hate this, but if he hears this, but he probably won't, so it doesn't matter.
I'm going to email it to him.
But he's a nonchalant. He's somebody who's very forgetful. Like, every time I see him, he's locked his keys in his car, or he came into my house one time and, like, a bird had crapped on him, and it's just like, I've got bird shit on me. It's like, I'm a nonchalant, you know? He's just a very forgetful person, so I don't think it was malicious that he didn't pay me to edit like the final version. I think he just like forgot about it. That said, I would hope that you would watch this movie and question it. Before I even got involved in this, I have like a real pet peeve with a couple things. I'll do the number one pet peeve before the secondary. The number one is reality TV. We watch that and we're like, this is happening. This is what is going on. Like, this pregnant teenager or whatever is having this baby, sure. And this drama that she's having with her boyfriend is totally real.
We eat it up with a spoon. Not me, but Matt Kay and those people of the world.
No. Give me at least that much credit, Ryan.
And then on the other end, you have like found footage films. And then you also have the news, which has to like redact stuff a lot. And they mess up too, but news we consider like authoritative. Although we have, you know, Fox News, which is bullshit. And then we have, even though I lean more this way, we have MSNBC, which can be bullshit a lot, too. We have, like, subjectivity is too pronounced and too available and too ready to be swallowed that I think people sometimes need to have, what people need to have shoved down their throat is the desire to question what's being shoved down your throat. To be like, this is like, this isn't real. This is partially real, but it turned into something that's totally bullshit. And, you know, maybe I didn't, I don't know. I'll get to like kind of my most ambitious films and I can kind of get into this again, but I wanted people to question this and I wanted, people to understand that not all narrators are reliable.
Definitely. Well, congratulations on the film again, Spencer. Thanks. And for the Jawheads, definitely. If you didn't check it out with us pumping it, you know, out on Facebook and Twitter, do so, especially after discussion. One last question about the Institute. The awesome artwork on the poster. Who did that? And I love it. It really sells the movie.
That was Mark Weaver. He's a really brilliant graphic designer. You can check out like some of his other work. He did some work for the games as well. And then after everything was done, Jeff put me in touch with him, and he did the poster for the film. Mark Weaver, he's a brilliant graphic designer.
Big fan. And for the Jawheads at home who want to maybe purchase this movie, where's the best place to do so online?
Well, to purchase it, I'm still kind of in debt from this movie. I never expected it to get the success it has. Netflix is a good place, or we picked up a distributor with Gravitas Ventures. And so Netflix or iTunes or Amazon, those are all great places.
And Spencer, do you have any projects coming up that you can talk about? What's next?
Yeah, I have one that I just finished up. I wanted to do something as completely different from the Institute as I possibly could, both in terms of not being a documentary and, being all about like the image itself. I've been working for 14 months on an animation that's just now finishing up. So I'm just about done with it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Please let us know when that comes out, man. Absolutely. Right, I'll follow you on Twitter.
Yeah.
And make sure I keep in touch.
We'll have to have you back on the Jaw when that drops.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. Awesome.
So again, Jawheads, the name of the film is The Institute. It's streaming on Netflix. Definitely check it out. Let us know what you think. We'll retweet it and get the discussion going when you shoot us a tweet on Twitter at CinemaJaw. Matt, it brings us to our top three most ambitious film projects, and you're getting a start at this week, buddy.
All right. I'm coming out swinging, man.
Oh, boy. Here we go.
I'm swinging my orcish scimitar.
Can't wait.
Ready? My number three most ambitious film project, Lord of the Rings. Peter Jackson's epic trilogy is a modern-day marvel of cinema. It's an accomplishment. What he did in special effects, he invented. If there wasn't something he had, he freaking invented it. The forced perspective stuff that he did, so much thought and
motion
planning.
Capture.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it broke out Andy Serkis.
Not to mention filming all three movies at the same time, which was a humongous risk.
And a big strain on him, physically, mentally, at his relationships, his family. It was a very ambitious project. It's the Lord of the Rings. I mean, I think it needs to be mentioned.
My wedding ring is actually a gold ring that has one Jenny to rule them all on the inside.
Aww. Nice.
Die hard ringer.
See, so Spencer likes that pick.
Nice.
It's good.
I agree. I agree with the pick. I like it. Spencer, we swing it over to you. What do you got sitting at number three?
So I kept mine pretty relevant to this kind of genre of the Institute. My number three pick is pretty unknown, but it's Bobcat Goldthwait's Windy City Heat. it's a movie where basically Bobcat Goldthwait decided to tell somebody that they were going to be in a movie and then just mess with this person for 3 months, and the real movie was the making of the movie, of like messing with this guy and watching their expectations for fame and success just like crumble to the ground. I really love it.
I'm beginning to like Bobcat more and more as a filmmaker.
What
was that one he did with Bill Murray's brother? Oh, it was so good.
Throw it in the jaw box.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot to mention, Spencer, if you forget a fact, we could throw it in the jaw box, and our engineer Elias will come back at the break with all the stuff we
all
forgot.
The facts. Yeah.
Great.
Plus, he has a new movie coming out. It premiered at the, I should say it screened at least at the Chicago Critics Film Fest. Throw it in there as well. There's a new film.
Willow Creek.
Willow Creek. He's doing great stuff lately.
And Shakes the Clown was great. It's just a shame he took so long to follow it up.
All right. Nice pick. Nice pick there at number three. Swing it over to mine. And at number three, I have a film came out in 2002. Mr. Tom Hanks is in there. Holly Berry's in there. Jim Broadbent. Directed by the Wachowskis.
Swordfish, right? Swordfish.
Directed by the Wachowskis. I'm speaking of Cloud Atlas. And while I can't say for sure that it was an ultimate success of a film, I think that the film was obviously extremely ambitious. You got multiple storylines spanning hundreds of years with actors playing multiple characters throughout the movie. It's just an ambitious idea, I guess, that everything is connected, that something that somebody does 50 years earlier actually has an effect on your life. I just love the idea of it. The book, I have not read it. I know our engineer Elias, and maybe when he pops out of the Jawbox, can comment on the book. The movie, I think it missed its mark for greatness, but it had a lot there, too, that I loved. Some of the storylines were awesome. So Cloud Atlas for ambitious project.
I thought that movie was a triumph for what it attempted and what it was able to achieve. If people are complaining about, you know, that movie not totally nailing it,
right,
it's just because like Einstein wasn't directing it. Yeah. You know,
I think when I first reviewed it on The Jaw, I said, well, it's like if everybody was diving off the same height of the diving board. Well, this one went for a little bit more, you know? So for me to knock it, yeah, it didn't hit its mark, but it was going for such such potential that it's like, well, it still hit like 7 out of 10, which is still almost a 4-jaw movie on any other scale, you know what I mean? So
right,
and I love the score of that movie. Boy, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, that was my number 3, Cloud Atlas. We're into our 2s. Matt, what do you got?
Number 2, you're gonna kill me for this, Ryan, and Spencer, I don't know how you feel about this, but I had to do it. I have the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Yeah, you know,
all of them?
Yes, and I'm going to take that sound box and I'm going to shove it up your ass.
Shove it up your ass.
So listen, it's an accomplishment. I don't think any other studio has been able to put this together so far, and they've all tried and failed. They've put what we love about the comic books, which is the continuity and how they all flow in and out of each other's titles, on the big screen.
And DC is not going to be able to do that.
They're going to try.
Not. They're going to fail. Well, I wasn't a fan of Man of Steel, personally.
Nobody was, except for this guy.
I liked it,
left.
But yeah, I doubt Batman and versus Superman is going
to
be.
Unfortunately, they're going to try so hard to replicate Marvel's magic, and it's going to be a failure. You know, got to think outside the box here, guys.
So I think it's an ambitious project and one that's been successful for them.
I'll disagree for the time being.
I'll agree with you. That, what was it, Kevin Feige or whoever the head of Marvel is, I forget his name.
It's changed
Jawbox.
A couple times.
Throw it in the Jawbox.
I will agree that it is brilliant how they were able to tie, what is it now, like 7 or 8 movies into a parallel storyline.
Yeah.
My only thing is, like, I felt like it kind of culminated with the Avengers. It's like, where does it end? You know, like, with Lost, I really wanted Lost to just end at the 4th season. Like, most of them got off the island, but, you know, a few of them didn't. Whatever, the show's over. Where does the Marvel Cinematic Universe end?
Well, if you're asking me the question, I'd answer the comic books don't end. It keeps going. It's a serial.
Oh, wrong answer. Yeah. All right. Spencer, Spencer, what do you got sitting at number 2?
Number 2... You know what? I was going to do Exit Through the Gift Shop, but I thought about it earlier. It's a little too contrived. I'm going to go with Being John Malkovich.
Oh, great pick.
Yeah.
That's just a nice one right there.
I don't know if it's the most ambitious, but what's ambitious about it is the fact that somehow Charlie Kaufman and Spike Jonze were able to talk whatever studio that was into giving them the money to do that.
I agree.
How the heck did that happen? Like, how do you talk a studio into giving you money for that?
I agree. I would have loved to see the sales pitch on that this movie was going to take place in John Malkovich's head.
Well, I've read interviews with Charlie Kaufman where apparently, you know, there's the 7.5 floor of the building that John Cusack works at. And originally it was supposed to be Being Corey Feldman, but that didn't work out for some reason.
Thank God.
Yeah. And when they switched it to Being John Malkovich, John Malkovich's agent apparently came and said, why do you want John Malkovich to do this? And they go, oh, I just think he'd be good. He's like a cool character actor. Like, I think he's kind of interesting looking and I like his like voice. And they go, okay, do you know that? And this is a Jawbox, but it's pretty close. I'm kind of paraphrasing, but they go, did you know that John Malkovich lives on the 7.5 floor of his apartment? they like thought they were Charlie Kaufman was a stalker or something, like writing a script specifically about like John Malkovich.
That's weird, man.
Yeah, wow. It's super weird.
Great movie, great pick right there. At number two, I go with the 2006 Darren Aronofsky film that I probably might be one of his weakest in his filmography. But when we're coming to ambition, and when I read what little budget he had on this film, I'm speaking of The Fountain.
Yeah, I like it.
I mean, we're talking three storylines, people all looking sort of for the fountain of youth, if you will. Now I read when I was doing the research for Cinema Jaw, he made this film on a budget of $35 million, which may sound like a lot, but this is a spectacle to be had. And it's Hugh Jackman, Rachel Weisz, and like I say, it spawns, you know, three storylines. You got like the old Mayan country where a guy searches for the Tree of Life. And you also have all the way up to like modern day. And then you have the future where they're in space and he's carrying around this tree with him. If you haven't seen it, anything Aronofsky has made is worth a spin. Might not be his best work, but again, maybe his most ambitious, I think.
I like it, yeah. Kind of a precursor to Cloud Atlas, actually.
It is. They're both in the same realm. As I picked both those, I thought, God, they're very similar in what they were sort of trying to tackle.
Yeah, for sure.
That was my number two. We're into our ones, guys. Matt, what do you got sitting there?
All right, so mine is a documentary, and the documentary itself is not the ambitious project. It's a documentary about an ambitious project. It's called Man of Lost in La Mancha.
Yeah.
And it's about Terry Gilliam's stab at the Don Quixote film, which was ill-fated, to say the least. It almost seems like it's cursed. There's just this comedy of errors that happens. Everything goes wrong. Like the first day on set, they set up this beautiful set, and that night there's this horrible typhoon or downpour, and they're in the freaking desert. This, like, it's like way out of season. Their whole set gets ruined. It destroyed like thousands of dollars worth of stuff. Like Johnny Depp comes in, and then I think he gets sick or something. I forget. But like everything that can go wrong
goes wrong.
And it's like this has happened with other people trying to make a Don Quixote film. And I think if anybody had been able, was able to do Don Quixote, it would have been Terry Gilliam. It's a really interesting movie, and I think somebody's about to do a Don Quixote picture. It's coming out pretty soon. So it's
I heard Terry Gilliam was going to try to do it again.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
I don't know.
That'll work out, but
that's big. Yeah. All right. What do you got sitting at number one, Spencer?
Well, that's funny because the other guy who failed to do a Don Quixote picture was Orson Welles, which brings me to my number one film. Orson Welles failed pretty miserably, and I think there was a documentary made about his failure at Don Quixote as well. That's another job box. Pretty sure there was at least a really good essay done about it. But my final film would be F for Fake, which is a documentary by Orson Welles, probably the number one inspiration for the Institute, where the film starts off and he says, Orson Welles says, "Everything I'm about to tell you over the next hour is 100% fact. But what he doesn't tell you is that the film is 77 minutes long, and that at the very end of the film, the last 17 minutes of the film is just total BS. It's just total bull. And then finally, at the very end of the film, he says, everything I just told you for the last 17 minutes is a complete lie, which is maybe something I should have done with the Institute. Although it wasn't the last 17 minutes, it was kind of sprinkled throughout. But the clues are there with the Institute to figure that out. I don't know. Orson Welles, personal hero of mine.
I love Orson Welles, and I have not seen that film. I'm putting it on my queue tonight.
Do it.
I've seen that film, Ryan.
Have you?
Yeah, are you impressed?
No.
You should be.
No. Every once in a while, the guy tries to one-up me with one of these.
It was his last major film. Nice. Before he got into a glorious drunk and haze and then made Transformers. the animated voice, yeah.
Oh, hilarious.
It's a little bit of a strange movie. It's definitely, it's weird.
Nice. Yeah. For my number one, this one came out in 2011. I guess it polarized a lot of people. I was in the positive camp, but I think I like it even more now that time's passed. I'm speaking of Terrence Malick's Tree of Life.
I notice a theme.
Yeah, total theme going on here.
How about it? How about it? Obviously, Brad Pitt, Jessica Chastain. And I always talk about it. It really captures like the innocence of childhood and growing up. There's probably about a 20 or 30 minute segment in this movie that I thought was just absolutely masterful. Maybe one of the best 20 to 30 minute segments I've ever seen on film. And it is that sort of the boy losing his innocence, the childhood of it all, growing up. And here he's got the whole scope of trying to figure out the meaning of life, you know. You got dinosaurs in the movie. It just gets wild. Sean Penn's in there standing on a beach. And yet I think if you soaked it all in on a good Sunday morning when you were watching it with a cup of coffee, you would agree. It was just a masterpiece of a film. Again, humongous ambition going in. So even if you didn't like it, you got to applaud the ambition here.
Yeah, definitely.
So that was my number one pick. Jawheads, if we missed one of your favorite ambitious film projects, and keep in mind, we only did three because it was our movie club pick that we were really focusing on this week. And you have Twitter pulled up. Shoot us a tweet at CinemaJaw. We'll retweet it. We'll get the discussion going. What we're going to do is we're going to take a break. When we come back, we have a cinema war looking at should they get rid of the PG-13 rating, and also trivia. Cameron Diaz, Jason Segel movie trivia. Jason Segel movie
Jason
trivia.
Jason Segel. Say it right.
Yeah, damn it. We'll be right back on CinemaJaw.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Hi, I'm Matt Kay with a CinemaJaw movie fact. The chariot race in the film Ben-Hur required 15,000 extras on a set constructed on 18 acres of backlot at Cinecittà Studios outside Rome. Tour buses visited the set every hour. 18 chariots were built, with half being used for practice. The race took 5 weeks to film. And that is your CinemaJaw movie fact.
To get ourselves a treat.
And we are back on CinemaJaw, hanging out with director Spencer McCall. He has directed The Institute. It is streaming on Netflix. Jawheads, check it out. Let us know what you think. Shoot us a tweet. We'll retweet it, get the discussion going. We want as many people to see The Institute as possible. Before we get to Cinema War, before we get to trivia, we stuffed a bunch of facts in that damn jaw box, didn't we, Matt?
Yeah.
Let's open up that jaw box.
What's your pleasure, Mr. Cotton?
The box.
We got a box! Oh, what's in the box?
Hey, what's going on, guys? You know, Spencer, last week we were talking about doing a documentary of CinemaJaw, and specifically the Jaw Box. Today we haven't talked about it much, but Matt keeps me in here all week in this small, tiny box. You could barely see me on Skype, I'm sure. But yeah, and it's funny, too, because in our documentary, most people think I'm acting, but I'm not. I really spent the night here. But all right. Anyway, let's see here. Let's get with these questions.
We've actually taken to throwing our gear in the box as well.
Yeah.
So it's really cramped.
Oh, yeah. Imagine sleeping on mic stands, you know. Let's see. The first one was Bobcat's movie with Joel Murray, and that is God Bless America.
God Bless America. Yeah, that was a good movie. Surprisingly good.
Right after the holidays here. Let's see. The head of Marvel Studios is Kevin Feige.
Great. All right. Yes. So I pronounced it wrong, but yeah.
Well, you know what? That's a guess.
Okay.
So let's
Siri
just
didn't tell you that?
No, she didn't.
Okay.
That's his only friend, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. We're in a fight right now, so I'm not talking to her.
His Siri is not voiced by Scarlett Johansson either.
Let's see. And Orson Welles did do a Don Quixote. He tried to do it, and he worked on it. He started filming in 1955 and worked on it till the day he died in 1985.
Wow.
Off and on.
Wow. There you go. See, Elias, he's in that damn jaw box. He gets all the facts for us, Matt.
He's the best.
And we reward him with this. Get back in that jaw box.
Thank you.
Watch out for that mic stand.
Matt, it brings us to a segment called
Cinema War.
And Cinema War works like this, Jawheads. This is where me and Matt battle on a topic each week. And our guest this week, Spencer McCall, gets to play judge and jury and tell the Jawheads who he thinks won this Cinema War. And it's important because we're battling for 20 seconds to rant and rave on whatever you want. And Matt made a ridiculous statement at the beginning of the Jaw, saying that he thinks there should be no more PG-13 rating. Ludicrous. Heck, Elias, tell the Jawheads at home what today's Cinema War topic is.
Today's Cinema War topic, should the MPAA get rid of the PG-13 rating? Matt, you'll be fighting for yes, it's useless. Rye, you'll be fighting no, it's good for parents. Let the Cinema War begin.
Get rid of the PG-13 rating? That's fucking ridiculous. The problem is not the rating, but the parents who ignore them. The MPAA, who does not care as much about violence as they do nudity, is a problem, but don't get rid of the PG-13 rating.
Listen, for the record, I'm of the opinion that the entire rating system and the MPAA needs to be abolished, or at the very least, majorly revised. But the PG-13 rating is a perfect example of why. It muddles the already murky waters with arbitrary restrictions such as how many times you could say the word fuck without limiting violence much at all. Just remove the blood and you're okay. If we create films to adhere to false standards, then we get less than genuine filmmaking.
Yeah, but Matt, PG-13 has a valued place in the movie rating system. No children under the age of 13 allowed in without a parent. If you got rid of this, you could have some 10-year-old kid walk up to the ticket booth and say, two tickets for Naked Rambo, please. That doesn't help anyone, except maybe Sylvester Stallone.
I want to see Naked Rambo. I believe that a movie should be PG or it should be R. And don't even get me started on NC-17. Who are these MPAA people to be the moral watchdogs for America anyway? Kirby Dick's film, this film is not yet rated, made this observation for us. The documentary depicted the shady MPAA as a draconian organization. That's exactly what they are. Come on, this is stupid.
Yeah, but Matt, let's be serious here. What needs to happen is actually this MPAA has to look at too much violence the same way they do nudity and sex. Some of these films coming out rated PG-13 may not show any nipples, but they might have hundreds of people dying throughout. It's not the rating's fault itself, but rather the people monitoring it.
Actually, I think you're making my point for me.
No, I know. I'm saying it needs to be a stiffer PG-13.
I mean, what's next? PG-11? It's PG.
If it helps parents.
No, it doesn't help anybody.
Well, it should.
It's PG or it's R. Parents should make the decision
for
their own.
You're a parent?
I am. Parents should make the decision for their own children and not the MPAA, because not everyone has the same maturity levels at the same age. For instance, I know that when I was 13, I was way more mature than Rye the Movie Guy is now.
Oh, crap.
Plus, these ratings, they're not even enforced at the movie theaters.
Yeah, but here, all right, last point here. The problem is, and it always is, money. Studios fight hard to get this PG-13 rating to expand their audience. Thus, plenty of kids are exposed to more violence than they should be. Take away the PG-13 rating, you say, Matt? Bullcrap. I say strengthen that rating and stick to your guns, pun intended, when rating these violent movies.
This is unbelievable. I swear to God, you're making my argument for me.
No, I want the PG-13 rating.
My fourth point.
What is your fourth point?
The PG-13 rating is stupid. Follow the money. This is my point. Follow the money. The rating system has become a marketing decision more than anything else. How do we want to position our movie? The original Red Dawn was PG-13. Wolverines! I rest my case.
Oh, boy, oh, boy. Buttonheads, as always, on Cinema War. We throw it over to our guest, our judge, our jury this week, Spencer McCall. What'd you think of this Cinema War?
Sure, it was good. You both made some great points. I'm a little bit torn. I will say that, you know, I do value the ability for a parent to decide what their kid is allowed to see. I remember one of my best birthdays was turning 13 and my mom taking me to see The Relic, which was rated R, and I just loved it. You know, it's not a great movie, but when you're 13, like a monster movie in a museum is just like amazing, and it kind of like changed, I don't know, it something about The Relic was really important to me. I know nobody else thinks that way, but then when I got into like being right after that birthday up until like being about age 18, I used to get really frustrated with the fact that you had to pay for an adult ticket
when you were over 13, but you couldn't see the rated R movie until you were 17. So I don't know if that's really an endorsement for PG-13 movies or kind of an argument towards it. I think I'm going to have to lean a little bit more towards Ryan on this one.
That we need it?
Unfortunately. Not that we need it. Not that we need it, but that the rules... The MPAA's rules need to be reassessed a little bit.
I agree with that.
The number one reason I'm going to go with Ryan is not because I think turning 13 makes you more, you know, accepting of violence or whatever on screen, but simply because Spielberg invented the PG-13 rating for Temple of Doom. And Temple of Doom, even though it's a lot of people's least favorite, it's my favorite Indiana Jones. And I gotta endorse Spielberg and Temple of Doom with PG-13.
Wow, another win underneath my belt, Matt.
I'm sorry, Matt. I really am. You're a great guy, but
it's okay.
I love Temple of Doom.
I love Temple of Doom also.
Hey, that earns me 20 seconds to rant and rave on whatever I want. And you know, this has sort of turned into a documentary show since we were talking about the Institute. I did see another film, but we were so jam-packed on this jaw, I didn't have a time to squeeze in a full review. I did see Roger Ebert's documentary about Roger Ebert, Life Itself. It is playing in select cities. It's also video on demand as well. And Matt, this is a celebration of film. It's a celebration of life. They show you the good of Roger Ebert. They also go over a lot of times when he was drinking, and he was a hardcore drinker. I didn't realize this in his younger days. Actually met his wife at an AA meeting, to give you an idea. Truly remarkable film, because I believe Ebert really felt that film connects us, and he didn't want to have anything from his life hidden. So when they made this movie, they showed the good, the bad, the ugly.
Warts and all.
Yeah, and I absolutely adored this film. It's a four-jaw documentary. Get out there and see it, jawheads.
Nice. All right. Well, now I feel a little better about you winning.
Yeah. Boy, here
just
we go.
Just a little.
I want to see that.
All right. The movie is called Sex Tape. It stars Cameron Diaz and Jason Segel. And because of that, we are playing Cameron Diaz, Jason Segel movie trivia. It works like this. Spencer, you're our guest. You get to choose if you want to go first or let Matt go first. There are steals if the person doesn't know it. And if you get hung up on one question, our engineer, Elias Rodriguez, has clues to all the questions. You get one trip to the ER.
I will go first.
Question number one over to Spencer. Jason Segel voiced Vector, arch nemesis of Gru in Despicable Me. Which actor voiced Gru?
Steve Carell.
1-0. They always start off easy. Couple of lobs to begin the game. calm everybody's nerves.
Sure.
Question number two over to Matt Kay. Cameron Diaz starred alongside Tom Cruise in Vanilla Sky, and also in this 2010 action comedy film, which sees Tom Cruise play a spy.
Night and Day.
Everybody's perfect here. 1-1. We go to question number three over to Spencer. Spencer, Jason Segel is devastated after breaking up with his girlfriend, played by Kristen Bell. So he takes a Hawaiian vacation in this film.
Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
2-1. Spencer, Matt, question four. In I Love You, Man, Jason Segel becomes best friends with Paul Rudd. What band do they both love and eventually go see in concert?
Oh, no.
I can steal it.
Oh, AC/DC.
Rush.
One more time, Spencer.
Rush.
You blew that one, Matt. It is now 3-1, Spencer.
I was going to say Gwar.
Well done, Spencer. Well done.
I have a hardcore Paul Rudd fan wife, so I see them all.
Nice. It is 3-1, Spencer, and question number five is back over to him. In the 2008 movie, What Happens in Vegas, Cameron Diaz marries this actor in order to get a large sum of money.
This is for me?
Yes.
Ashton Kutcher.
It's a slaughter at this point. It is 4-1, Spencer. Matt, you need these ones.
Didn't
here.
I at least get two of them right?
No, you only had the one. Oh. Question six over to you, Matt. Cameron Diaz played one of the Charlie's Angels in the two big screen adaptations.
Yeah.
Name the other two actresses who played the Angels in the films.
Lucy Liu, and that would be the chick that always plays with Cameron with Adam Sandler, Drew Barrymore.
Now you have.
I can't believe I just called her. She's Drew Barrymore. She's an American treasure.
Oh, I wouldn't go that far, please.
Well, yeah, E.T.
Granddaughter of John Barrymore, famous silent film actor.
I'm still not giving her American treasure.
She's
status.
An American treasure.
She's not an American treasure.
She is.
No, she's not, man.
Yeah,
double
she's America's
war.
Sweetheart.
Oh, Jesus,
sweetheart.
All right, sweetheart, maybe, but not treasure. Jesus. All right, 4-2. 4-2. Back over to. Spencer, question number 7. Jason Segel dates Emily Blunt for a long time in this 2012 romantic comedy.
5-year engagement.
This guy's on his
game. Oh, he is. He is. It is 5-2. The game is over, but save face here, Matt. Last question of the game. Name the 1997 film that starred Cameron Diaz and Ewan McGregor, who plays a cleaning man who takes his boss's daughter, Diaz, hostage.
I'd
Holy
like a
shit,
trip.
I don't know this one. I'd like sorry, start with the language.
It's okay. I'd like a trip to the ER, please.
Oh, a trip to the ER. Elias Rodriguez, what was the name of that Cameron Diaz, Ewan McGregor film?
Thank you, guys. I was afraid this was going to be the first time I wasn't going to have a trip to the ER here. Let's see. Your clue is being unusual the whole time you're alive.
That's the name of a movie?
No, that's
a clue.
His clue.
That's his clue.
Oh.
Strange Life? I don't know.
Ewan McGregor. Anything sparking for you, Spencer?
No, nothing. I've never heard of this.
Any guess? Nothing?
Nothing.
We were looking for A Life Less Ordinary.
Nope.
Nope.
Never even heard of
that. Oh, it's a smaller film. Check it out, though, Jawheads. Definitely check it
out.
All right. Yeah.
I think I remember. It's kind of an action movie, right?
No, it's not. Oh. It's a good film. I check it out. Spencer wins this one 5-2. He walks away with it. Well done, Spencer.
Well done. Here's
thank you, guys.
Virtual
thank
handshake.
You.
There you go.
Boom.
Yeah, we always have a jawbreaker in case it came to a tie. This would have went to you, Spencer. Which Cameron Diaz movie is worse, Bad Teacher or The Counselor?
You know, I haven't... The Counselor is the Ridley Scott thing. I haven't... Or... Yeah, it's Ridley Scott, right?
I believe it is.
I haven't seen either. I'm going to assume Bad Teacher's worse.
That's incorrect. You would have lost that one.
It's oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Right. Actually, you are correct. That's true.
Here's the real jawbreaker. Age of Cameron Diaz. Closest to. Spencer, you got a guess?
116. No, I'm just kidding. No, she doesn't. She looks great. I don't know. Early 40s, mid 40s, maybe.
We need a number.
I don't know.
We need a number.
I'm going to say 42.
Lock him in at 42. Matt, you got to guess?
That's the answer. I would say $1, Bob. 41.
We'd give that one to Matt. 41 on the nose. All Both right. of you guys well are done. Honed in on well that done. One. Well done. Well done. Whew. Matt, it brings us to the end of a great cinema jaw.
Yeah, it does. And Spencer, I just want to tell you that I'm a fan, dude. I cannot wait to see
thank
what you.
You
do next. I'm excited. Thanks. I'm excited for your animation, and thank you for creating The Institute. It was a very enjoyable movie.
Thank you very much, guys. Thank you. I really appreciate you taking the time. And you know, for some reason, Chicago just really. You guys are terrific. You guys really like the movie, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Hey, if you're ever in town, you know, we'll buy you a beer. We'll watch a movie together.
I try to get to Chicago like once every 1 to 2 years, so I will definitely let you know.
Definitely look us up.
Yeah, please do.
We also got to thank our sponsors.
Yeah, thanks to the new 400.
And also thanks to Redbox Instant. They're on our website. Click on them, Jawheads, at cinemajaw.com. It's just like Netflix, but you get 4 free rentals at their kiosks as well. And if you click on their ad on our website, you get a free month of their rentals.
Yeah, that's a good win-win.
We also got to thank the best engineer in the biz, Elias Rodriguez.
Thank you, guys. I want to give a shout-out to Drew Barrymore, America's sweetheart. And go watch Blended, this summer's best decent crap movie.
Wow, man. We should put him back. I'm going to put a lock on the job.
I tell you what, that guy's a son of a bitch. All right, till next week, check us out on Facebook.
Follow us on Twitter.
And keep on jawing about the movies. Spencer, thanks a ton.
So much.